Following the attack on an Iranian diplomatic building in Syria, we get the latest from the United Nations.
They asked the Council, the Security Council, to condemn the attack, and they also said they reserved the right to, quote, take a decisive response to it.
Plus, there's a new military conscription law in Ukraine. We get the latest from Kyiv.
A bill should help to increase the size of Ukraine's fighting force amid tough situation on the battlefield and preparation for a new massive Russian assault.
And later, dengue fever in Peru and the plight of Sudanese refugees. Today is Friday, April 12th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Earlier this month, an Iranian diplomatic facility in Syria was attacked, killing top military commanders. It's widely speculated that Israel is behind the attack, though the country has never confirmed it publicly. Iran has vowed revenge. The AP's Charles Deledesma has more.
Israel's military says it's prepared to defend the country and strike back if Iran decides to retaliate for this month's deadly airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Syria. Tehran holds Israel responsible for the attack, which the U.S. military believes Israel carried out. Israel has not commented on it. The increased tensions have sparked concern that Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza could spill over into the rest of the Middle East. The war has pushed Gaza into a humanitarian crisis, leaving more than 1 million people on the brink of starvation. I'm Charles Deledesma.
The threat of an Iranian retaliation is on the minds of the UN Security Council as well. For a look at what's happening, here's VOA's Margaret Bashir at the UN in New York.
Iran immediately wrote to the United Nations, to the Secretary General, and to the head of the UN Security Council on the 1st of April to protest the attack. And they said it was a flagrant violation of the UN Charter, international law, and the principle of the inviolability of diplomatic premises, which means they're sort of sacred. And they asked the Council, the Security Council, to condemn the attack. And they also said they reserved the right to, quote, take a decisive response to it. Then on Thursday, the Iranian mission to the United Nations posted on the social media platform X that had the Security Council condemned the Israeli act of aggression on their premises in Damascus, and had there been accountability for those who carried it out, then, quote, the imperative for Iran to punish this rogue regime might have been obviated. So they're saying maybe we wouldn't be in this position where we have to take retaliatory action. The Security Council did discuss the situation. Normally, they would condemn an attack on diplomatic premises. It's a pretty straightforward exercise. There's always a statement. Russia's ambassador said Thursday that his delegation had drafted a statement, a condemnation of the attack, but he said it was blocked by what he called the Anglo-Saxons, mainly the United States, Britain, and France. On the council. These statements have to be by consensus. Council diplomats told me that there were problems with that statement. They raised objections over naming Israel as the perpetrator of the attack when Israel doesn't really claim these strikes publicly, although Israeli officials have certainly signaled that they were behind it. And some diplomats also raise the issue that while indeed diplomatic premises are protected, they should also not be used for covert operations. And some believe Iran may have been doing that in Damascus. So that was a sticking point. So that's where we are. And for his part, the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, he doesn't want to see any regional escalation. So he's certainly concerned about what's going on.
Israel is on high alert for what the White House says is a real threat of imminent Iranian retaliation for the airstrike that killed senior Iranian commanders in Damascus last week. U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said on Friday that the U.S. deems Iranian officials' repeated warnings of retaliation against Israel made in recent days to be real and viable. Benny Sabti is an Iran researcher at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies. My colleague Michael Lippin asked him how Israelis are reacting.
They are also very aware about the situation. They are talking about it. They are talking about the news. Those who know me ask me about what is going to happen. I was in two TV shows and I explained that we can be a little bit calmer, but being aware, just because the Iranian regime have the same kind of weapons and ammunition. It's not different from what Hezbollah has or Hamas has. So yeah, the range is different, but it's the same. So we can be a little bit more calm and just follow the instructions, and that's it. So the Israelis, like always, they live in two worlds in the same time. Just a regular Israeli day.
Just another regular day in Israel, but perhaps not so regular because of this heightened threat. And I was wondering, what are your best guesses about what Iran is going to do next year?
It seems that Iran is going to attack with some numbers of drones and some numbers of missiles. We cannot know that until that moment. And also, all this can be canceled because a sudden decision of the leader that we cannot know about that, because it's a dictatorship and that they can call it off in the last moment. So all the signs that also come from Americans are very cooperative with Israel now. All the divisions are put aside. They are putting aside all the differences and all the criticized, and they are supporting Israel and also Europe, Germany, England, France, and all the others.
So do you think this rallying of support for Israel among its Western allies, the US, the Europeans, is this having some kind of impact on Iran? Do you think it's making the Islamic Republic think twice about what to do?
It can minimize the reaction. They have to react because they are obligated to it, but it can minimize it. And we heard a few news about a promise from Iran regime that it can be a kind of reaction that Israel can accept and not react to that. Because this is the main problem. If Israel reacts to the Iranian reaction. So if the Iranians do the minimum and Israel can kind of ignore it, ignore the results, if some missiles fall in the desert, I don't know. Most of them, actually, they are not so sophisticated. The Iranian ammunition is not sophisticated. Most of them can fall in Iraq, in Jordan, in the middle of their way. And also Israel can neutralize them in the middle of their way with the system of Arrow and Iron Dome. So Israel is not so kind of impotent. I don't know how to call it. So Israel have a lot of capabilities.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Benny Sabti of Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies. Is the attack like the one at the Moscow Concert Hall last month possible in the United States? The FBI seems to think so. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner has more.
This is by no means a time to let up or dial back.
FBI Director Christopher Wray on Thursday, testifying before a House budget panel, expressed concerns about a possible organized attack in the United States, similar to the one that killed scores of people at a Russian concert hall last month.
As I look back over my career in law enforcement, I would be hard-pressed to think of a time where so many threats to our public safety and national security were so elevated all at once. But that is the case as I sit here today.
U.S. officials have been worried about the possibility of an attack inspired by the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. But Ray said concerns have escalated following the concert massacre in Russia that killed at least 144 people. Ray also pressed lawmakers to renew a U.S. surveillance program set to expire this month, saying it was key to help fight against terrorist attacks.
An absolutely indispensable tool that Congress can give us in our fight against foreign adversaries is the reauthorization of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It is critical in securing our nation, and we are in crunch time with our 702 authority set to expire next week.
Ray cited the FBI's concerns about terrorism to help persuade lawmakers to boost funding for the agency, but he is likely to face strong pushback from congressional Republicans, as the FBI has become a prime target for former President Donald Trump, who has called on Congress to slash the law enforcement agency's funding, alleging it has unfairly targeted him while going soft on his political enemies.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Some military aid for Ukraine might be coming from an unlikely place. We'll learn more in a moment. Now, though, to Kyiv, where a new military mobilization bill adopted by the parliament is expected to be signed by President Volodymyr Zelensky very soon. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On April 11, the Ukrainian parliament adopted a long-awaited bill on military mobilization. A bill should help to increase the size of Ukraine's fighting force amid tough situation on the battlefield and preparation for a new massive Russian assault. The final version of the document is significantly different from the initial version. The main difference is the exclusion of rules regarding the specific terms of demobilization of soldiers, which was demanded the most by the military and society because people believe the soldiers are deployed for too long. However, Oleksandr Sirsky, commander-in-chief of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, suggested this will be voted on separately. So far, here are the key changes that were introduced for conscripts. Citizens 25 to 60 years old are subject to mobilization under the new law. Electronic accounts will be introduced to accumulate data and simplify updates, and following Zelensky's signature, all conscripts will have 60 days to update their information. Ukrainians living abroad will be required to update their personal data as well. Controversially, convicts can be conscripted into military service, except those that have committed crimes against the national security of Ukraine. There will be no compulsory mobilization for women. However, women with medical or pharmaceutical education will have to register for military service if they are fit for service due to their health and age. Other women can register for the military voluntarily. Also, the bill introduces the list of people who are not subject to military service. This includes citizens who have specific health problems, men over 60 years old, and parents with three or more minor children, some students and essential employees of businesses that are critical for meeting the needs of the defense forces or the functioning of the economy during martial law. Civil servants, ministers, diplomats, members of parliament, a number of high-ranking officials, judges, employees of the National Police and National Anti-Corruption Bureau, etc., are also subject to mobilization deferment. President Zelensky is expected to sign the bill in the near future. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And now to South America. Javier Milei was sworn in as Argentina's president in December of 2023 on a pro-Western anti-corruption platform. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was there for the inauguration, and this week Milei said he is considering sending aid to help Ukraine's fight against Russia. Arina Shankarenko has this story, narrated for us today by Anna Rice.
In March, Argentina's president Javier Milei announced he plans to visit Ukraine in June as part of a European tour. The announcement came after President Zelensky attended Milei's December presidential inauguration in Buenos Aires. A Milei visit to Ukraine would send an important message, says Argentina's former ambassador to Ukraine, Lila Roldan Vasquez.
If President Milei makes a visit, if he can show to the other countries or have a need for other countries to follow this initiative and be more involved in a vocal support and concrete support to Ukraine.
It also would contradict a Russian message about Latin America, according to Christopher Hernandez-Roy with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It counters the Russian narrative that all of Latin America is locked in this non-alignment, non-interventionist kind of mood, which the Russians have actively been cultivating.
Milei is also planning on holding a Ukraine-Latin America summit in 2024 to bring Kyiv closer to the region. But that could be politically risky for both countries, says Alexey Atkidach with Ukrainian Research Institute Adastra.
перед Україною постає дилема. Добре, ми організуємо саміт.
Ukraine faces a dilemma. They can organize a peace summit in Argentina, but some other Latin American leaders may not come.
Most Latin American countries have previously stated they didn't plan on sending weapons to Ukraine. But Milei has already sent two Russian-made helicopters to Ukraine and says military aid could be a real possibility. Hernandez Roy says that's risky because Argentina relies on Russian exports of fertilizer and refined petroleum.
If Milei were to consider participating in some sort of swap of Soviet equipment for American equipment and send that to Ukraine, I would expect that the Russians will find ways to hurt and damage the Argentine economy.
Former Ambassador Vasquez adds that Argentina is an outlier and that Russia's strong trading relationships with Latin American countries have led most to remain neutral in the conflict. For Irina Shenkarenko in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Staying in South America, Peru has recently seen a massive increase in deaths from dengue fever. Reuters' Devi Rajaram has more.
Dengue-related deaths in Peru have tripled this year, according to the government, which says it is stepping up efforts to curb an epidemic of the disease, especially in poorer regions. Health officials this week fumigated poor neighborhoods across the capital, Lima, targeting areas like cemeteries where mosquitoes have been found to breed in water-filled vases placed at graves. Peru's health ministry as of Thursday reported 117 deaths from dengue this year, compared to just 33 during the same period last year. Suspected cases have also skyrocketed, reaching around 135,000. Peru's government this week approved an emergency decree allowing special economic measures to support efforts to control the outbreak. Experts say the dengue outbreak in Peru is made worse by climate change. Peru has been dealing with high temperatures and heavy rainfall since 2023 due to the El Niño weather pattern, which has warmed the seas off its coastline. Augusto Tarazona, an epidemiologist at the University of Lima, told Reuters the Aedes aegypti mosquito has been adapting to Peru's climate.
What's currently happening is that the mosquito has been adapting to climate change and has been reproducing at a faster rate than in previous years, affecting many regions where it was not present in previous years.
Mild symptoms of dengue include nausea, rashes, and body aches, while a rarer, severe form, which is more dangerous for infants and pregnant women, can cause internal bleeding and is potentially fatal.
That's Devi Rajaram of Reuters reporting for us. And U.S. President Joe Biden hosted Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. on Thursday, aiming to send a clear message to Beijing that it must stop behaving aggressively against its South China Sea neighbors. He underscored that any attack on the Philippines would activate a mutual defense treaty between Washington and Manila. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wita-Kuswara reports.
Ramped up aggression in the South China Sea, with Chinese Coast Guard vessels deploying water cannons and performing other dangerous maneuvers on Philippine boats. It was a focus of the trilateral summit Thursday between President Joe Biden and leaders of two U.S. allies in Asia, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr.
Any attack on Philippine aircraft, vessels, or armed forces in the South China Sea would invoke our mutual defense treaty.
China's so-called gray zone tactics of intimidation, including ramming into ships, fall dangerously close to triggering the mutual defense treaty between Washington and Manila. Marcos did not publicly mention China, but couched his words in diplomatic terms often used to target Beijing.
Facing the complex challenges of our time requires concerted efforts on everyone's part, a dedication to a common purpose, and an unwavering commitment to the rules-based international order.
Kishida is concerned with similar Chinese tactics around disputed islands in the East China Sea, called Diaoyu in China and Senkaku in Japan.
In the midst of compound crisis faced by the global community, multi-layered cooperation between allies and like-minded countries is essential if we are to maintain and bolster a free and open international order based on the rule of law.
Last week, the Philippines, the U.S., Japan, and Australia held joint naval and air operations in the South China Sea to deter Beijing, prompting criticism by Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning.
China is resolutely opposed to the Cold War mentality and bloc politics, and to words and deeds that make and exacerbate contradictions and undermine other countries' strategic security and interests.
Biden, Marcos, and Kishida announced new maritime defense deterrence measures alongside infrastructure investments in the Philippines and collaboration on global humanitarian assistance efforts. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today to Africa. Political violence in Sudan is forcing thousands of refugees, many of them children, to neighboring South Sudan for safety. There, though, they face a different threat, a collapsing healthcare system unable to provide them the care they need. Sheila Pony reports from Renk in the Upper Nile state of South Sudan.
Refugees fleeing fighting in Sudan arrive in Jodha, a transit point between Sudan and South Sudan. 12-year-old Bahita Al-Mahed endured the grueling multi-day journey on foot shortly after being diagnosed with breast cancer. Bahita is feeling sick today, and her mother, Neema Abdallah, speaks for her.
It started with some rashes and chest pain. Then it developed into something hard, like a stone. Her skin started to fall off, and it was getting worse and worse from there. That is when we realized that it was something serious.
According to aid group Save the Children, more than 600,000 Sudanese refugees and South Sudanese returnees have crossed into South Sudan since last April. The region is already facing a severe hunger crisis and an overburdened healthcare system. For the new arrivals, this border town proved less than they hoped for. Upper Nile State Minister of Information, Lucas Sadala, says deaths in the camp are on the rise.
I have reported 194. From 194, only two, one woman and one man.
The country's health sector got a shock earlier 2023 when international donors cut their contributions. Yolanda Aweldeng, South Sudan's Minister of Health, says her team is struggling to fill the gap with its small share of the country's total budget.
And as you know very well, the budget of the Minister of Health is barely 2%, it's 1.8%. And even that 1.8%, we don't get it. So, and when we get it and we try to push, you know, the amount of commodities and also the personnel we take there is not enough.
Iwell, the medical director at Reng Civil Hospital in Upper Nile State, explained local medical facilities are not equipped to handle chronic diseases.
Patients with cancers like breast cancers, cervical cancer, and a different form of cancers, and other they were in on chemotherapy, and when they came here, as we here, we are a county hospital, and there are some cases we cannot be handling them.
Bahita Al-Mahad's mother says her daughter survives on one meal a day, and her condition has worsened since arriving in Jodha. Some families say they will stay in South Sudan, while others such as Bahita hope the war back home will end soon so they can return to Sudan and get the specialized treatment they need. Sheila Oponi, VOA News, Reng, South Sudan.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.